This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series.
Right, time for the final part of the evening, where we get to ask interesting and entertaining questions to our readers. And by the way, we've had a couple of shits and a fuck in the readings, so we've definitely got explicit... explicit tags on iTunes, so you've got all...
A couple of shits.
You can all swear as much as you want to in the questions. And thank goodness we're not on radio, because I'm not having to apologise for it. However, let us start with Martin, or should I perhaps say Tanya?
Yeah.
Now, this sort of thing is, of course, very common these days, but I have to say, and I am something of an expert in these matters, that if you were to present yourself to a gender clinic, they would probably make rude comments about how you're not passing very well as a woman. Now, fortunately, the trans community is very accepting of all sorts of non-binary identities these days, and you would fit right in. But could you perhaps explain to us a little bit about this dual identity of yours?
Yeah, I mean... you know, I know this is going out as a podcast, and for people who aren't actually seeing me, I'm not the most womanly of people that you might actually meet. It is always the first question that I get asked at an event: do you dress up when you write? And so I've actually started to preempt it by saying, no, I don't dress up when I write, because there's something very prurient about the kind of people who ask that question. Oh, somebody nodding behind me there. it's really quite simple in the way that it came about. It was because I was having coffee with my old editor one day, and he said, you know what I've got missing on my crime fiction list? I said, no. He said, a high-concept female thriller writer. He said, a kind of British version of Tess Gerritsen or Karen Slaughter or Chelsea Kane, somebody like that. And now, I've got a background as an actor, and the one thing that they always told you to do at drama school was, if somebody presents you with an opportunity, say you can do it. Because you can always learn some way to do it later. So I said, I can do that. He said, no, you can't. I said, I can, honestly, I can do that. He said, well, we'd have to put it out under a pseudonym. I said, well, clearly. It sort of shows the way that it also shows the way that how far crime writers go from being normal people, because I'd read a piece in the paper a couple of nights earlier, all about a serial killer who was targeting full-term pregnant women, cutting out their unborn children, and trying to raise them as their own, and this was a true story. So I see the room's gone quiet now. But instead of actually reading it and thinking, that's terrible, I just thought, there's a novel in that. And so when this editor said, pitch me a story, I said, okay, it's about a serial killer who targets full-term pregnant women and cuts out their unborn children to raise as their own. And it just also shows you how far from normality crime fiction editors are, because he said, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Give me 50 pages and a synopsis. So that was how Tanya came about. It was almost, and he said, you know, I bet you can't do this. And I said, I bet I can. And it was kind of strange after that, because the first book came out. It was a bestseller in Britain. It was called The Surrogate, and a bestseller in Europe as well. And it was Book of the Week in Smith's. And I remember standing in Smith's. They had like a special display of it, and watching people just kind of come in, get the newspaper and take the book off. And just, you know, just walk to this little person after person was doing this. And normally I would kind of say, I'm the author. Would you like me to sign that? But clearly, I'd have been arrested. So, and it was very, but it was up for an award as well. It was up for the Theakston's Award for best for crime novel of the year at the Harrogate Festival. And one of the provisos being that if you're shortlisted for that, you have to turn up and be interviewed on stage by Mark Lawson. So I did, and I didn't realise how much he was in on the joke until he started talking about the new International Woman of Mystery, Tanya Carver. And then he did invite the International Woman of Mystery, Tanya Carver, to the stage, and it was me in a cowboy shirt. And I thought I'd been very good at I'd been very bad at keeping the secret. My agent told me to stop getting drunk and telling people. But I realised that was a writer friend of mine sitting right down the front who, as soon as I took to the stage, shouted out, "Fucking hell, it's Martin." And I thought, I was actually better at this than I thought. So I didn't win, but at least it was Tanya's coming out party. So there's been another 7 since then, and it's been a very happy little diversion.
That was fine. That was absolutely fascinating. But the thing that gets me about this is in the science fiction and fantasy community, there's a huge amount of pressure on women writers to have initials like Rowling or to adopt a male pen name because otherwise they just don't sell. And yet here you are in crime fiction adopting a female pen name and selling like hotcakes. So what's the difference?
I think the main thing is that a lot of crime fiction readers are women. And especially, actually, I was talking to Maxim Jakubowski, who used to run Murder One Bookshop, and he said kind of that the amount of women who read true crime novels, especially novels about violence towards women, were young women in their 20s. And, you know, in the events that I've done as Tanya Carver, not dressing up... when I've spoken to writers, they've been thrilled if I've set a scene that's on their street. I said, but there's a horrible murder in it. Yeah, but it wasn't in my house. And I think that it's because a lot of the readership for crime fiction is female. And I think a lot of it is very much, they will read books about where women die horribly. And... It's strange, and on the one hand, I think I kind of shouldn't really go into this too much, and I did start to veer away from that towards the end of the Tanyas. I mean, there's 8 novels, so I didn't want to stick. The idea of the first novel, I was playing with the idea of gender as well, because but I thought with being a male writer writing as a woman, the villain, if you read the book, it's not so, there's a kind of fluidity of gender about who the villain is in that book as well. But I think also that a lot of women read crime fiction more than read science fiction. But it's also interesting because it's the same editor who, with J.K. Rowling, came up with the Robert Galbraith idea, who came up with Tanya Carver for me. So I kind of think of myself as a dry run in gender fluidity in crime fiction.
Oh, now I have a panel idea, Joe. I want to do this at BristolCon, and I want Martin on it, I want Sarah Hillary on it, and I want Sarah Pinborough on it, because we've got her, and we can talk about women and the weird stuff that they read. So, that will be good. Anyway, enough of this gender bending. You got me, you don't need any more. Paul, there were a heck of a lot of clues in there. And maybe sometime in the book people solve them. I'm not going to say anything because I've read the whole thing. But I think maybe for the benefit of the people on the podcast, we should talk about one or two other things. The Raish, for example, that there are actually real murders going on as well as ghost murders going on. And these are based on Sherlock Holmes stories.
Yes, there's a spate of crimes being committed across London, which our heroes work out are the crimes from the Conan Doyle short stories being done in order in the original locations. And they wonder if this has anything to do with the fact that, coincidentally, it seems, Sherlock Holmes has also been killed at the same time. And also, there are 3 different productions of various different types of Sherlock Holmes being filmed in London at the same time. So it all comes together in a web of mayhem and intrigue.
I did rather like your 3 different versions of Sherlock. You're clearly having a little riff off certain other things that are happening on the television. I particularly like the female Sherlock.
Well, thank you. It was very important for me to include her, but it's fond satire. And the book's got quotes on the front from Stephen Moffat and from Rob Doherty of Elementary, so I can't have offended them too much. I'm probably going to live.
So if I said who killed Sherlock Holmes, Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, then nobody's going to throw things at me. Maybe I'll edit that out before it goes to the podcast.
Enthusiastic nodding.
Yes, enthusiastic nodding there from Paul. Now, this is an ongoing saga, this of the Shadow Police, and some of the other things that perhaps readers coming fresh to it might not know is, first of all, that Quill, he's an inspector, isn't he? Inspector Quill, who's the leader of the team, has been to hell and back, and is deeply scarred by that. And also Lisa Ross, the team's analyst, has sacrificed her future happiness to get a bargain with the Dark Forces, so nothing can make her happy. And hopefully, maybe the team will get a little bit better.
Well, yes. I edited a little bit out as I read to sort of minimise continuity, but yes, they've in the previous two novels, that one of the team has literally been to hell, and Lisa has sacrificed her, is incapable of feeling happiness, anhedonia, as they call it. And so this all plays into an awful stew for where our heroes are, and that's all of the relationship stuff that was going on there. But as I say, we explain all this very quickly and simply. So if this is your first experience of the Shadow Police books, we hope people can join with this one. I've also got an opening sequence that's got Star Wars stormtroopers robbing a bank, which wasn't designed to be kind of timely at the time, but seems to have got there, you know.
I did see last week, and it might have been on BuzzFeed or something like that, this list of N urban myths that aren't really true, and the one about diggers being buried in the ground was amongst them.
I knew that one wasn't true when I used it, but that's true of many, many London lore things.
That's true. If enough people in London believe it, then it's true, and that's right. Okay, so the really important question, now that West Ham have played their last game at Upton Park, what is going to happen with the curse?
Well, the curse can go on to whatever housing estate's going to be built at Upton Park. So, thankfully, nobody's going to kill off anybody who scores a hat-trick against West Ham anymore. This has happened twice since London Falling came out. And Twitter's just dissolved at people. Yeah, Wayne Rooney's done it.
But nobody's killed him yet. Alrighty. Anybody else got any questions for our two readers? Joe was going to ask the West Ham question, and I have preempted her, which is very cruel of me. Does anybody actually want to? Otherwise, I'm going to be forced to ask them more questions. Yeah, Pete.
This is for Martin. Martin, you said that you have some sci-fi credentials. Do you want to share those with us?
I'm not sure if I do. Well, apart from, and listeners to the podcast will really appreciate this, as I've already stated, wearing the same boots that Peter Capaldi is wearing in Doctor Who, I did used to edit a Doctor Who fanzine. It was called Type 40. It ran for 3 issues, which, as I said earlier, is 2.5 longer than it should have done. The reason being the other half in the first issue was an interview with Robert Holmes. And I suppose that my little claim to fame is that it was part of that was used in the Robert Holmes biography that was published a couple of years ago, without my knowledge, I will say. I didn't know it until Paul told me that it had been in it at first. That's sort of my first foray into science fiction. I mean, I was surprised as anyone to realise that I'd ended up as a crime writer, because, I mean, growing up, all I did was read comics, watch Doctor Who, read science fiction books. And then suddenly one day I thought, I'm going to write a novel, and it came out as a crime novel. So I thought, where's this come from? I had absolutely no idea. I mean, since then I've written a horror novel. I was asked to write the official sequel to Susan Hill's Woman in Black to coincide with the Hammer film as well. And I knew it possibly was going to be my only chance to write a horror novel or a ghost story. So I threw everything at it. It's got, I mean, not just Susan Hill, it's got echoes of Poe in there as well, you know, with the House of Usher. I'm giving it away. In fact, so much so that in dead of night as well, there with, you know, haunted ventriloquist dummies, everything. I just chucked everything that I could in. So much so that the producer of the film actually phoned me up and said, could you rewrite it to be more like the film? The answer was no.
I guess we should also ask you about your acting career.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, should you really? It was a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. It was, that was all. I thought I was...
Are you Dave Prowse?
Am I Dave Prowse? Sorry, I was just asking the toilets tonight. I was mistaken for Dave Prowse, which is one of the worst chatterblinds I've ever heard.
Like Charlie Brooker.
Charlie Brooker? Oh, God, no, he's much shorter than me. I trained as an actor. That was my career. I went to drama school and... I became a kind of, I'm from the Northeast, so I was kind of a professional Northeast actor for a while. I did Catherine Cookson plays Spender with the great Jimmy Nail and loads of other stuff. My favourite job that I ever did was for an American TV series called The New Adventures of Robin Hood, which was, somebody groaned, they've obviously seen it. Oh, you've seen a couple of episodes. That's possibly a couple too much.
Is that the late 90s one?
It's the late 90s one.
Oh, I know that one.
Yeah. I think the microphone picked that up. It was great. I mean, it was brilliant. They took me off to Lithuania to film it, which was clearly, obviously, standing in for Sherwood Forest. And... It was the only time that guest starring Martin Waits will ever appear on an American TV show. So I was thrilled to see that, possibly overly thrilled, when I saw the rest of the episode. I played a wrestler who was put in prison with Friar Tuck because I'd refused to throw a game. Friar Tuck, obviously, 13th century friar, was really good at judo. So we had a fight. Rather, our stunt doubles did. We just sat there watching it and saying, Jesus, I was wrecked last night. And at the end of it, my line was supposed to be, this is my first line in it, was, no one has tossed me like that before. Which, strangely enough, was cut. This was after Fry Tuck had done a judo throw at me, I hasten to add. And... just to show what a kind of low-rent production it was, the first script that I got, he said, you're playing Giant. I said, Giant, thank you. And it was because the first line of stage direction was, a giant of a man looms up behind Friar Tuck. And to show what low-rent it is, they just used kind of, you know, find and replace, because they'd given me a name by this point. He said, you're now called Vincent. So in the actual shooting script, it said, a Vincent of a man looms up behind Friar Tuck. I felt I couldn't actually top this in my acting career, so I turned to writing novels instead.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm not going to ask you about your acting career, but I should ask you about This Damned Band, which I understand is available as a graphic novel.
This week also, This Damn Band, my collected mini-series from Dark Horse Comics about the most famous rock band of 1974, who liked to say, we worship the devil, only to find to their surprise and horror that actually they're worshipping the devil, comes out, is a collected edition, I'll be signing that and Who Killed Sherlock Holmes on release date for both of them, which is this Thursday at London's Forbidden Planet, and then I'll be back in Bristol on this Saturday to sign copies of both down Bristol's Forbidden Planet.
I do rather like the idea of a rock band that has Aleister Crowley as their road manager.
And they never realise.
Brilliant. However, this is a perfect segue into my asking Martin about that fascinating book on your website, Great Lost Albums.
Great Lost Albums. This is the most fun I've ever been paid for. I wasn't paid very much. We were actually paid a weekend in Hastings to write this book. It's a book that four of us wrote, three crime writers and a comedy writer called Dave Quantick. The other two crime writers are Mark Billingham and Stav Shires. It's all about great lost albums, albums that should have existed but never did. The Dylan and Liberace album, Kraftwerk's Christmas album, Coldplay's IKEA sessions when they were the house band for IKEA, The Velvet Underground and Lulu. I could go on. I should go on. Garth Brooks's good album, which was called Complete and Utter Country. It was. It was Mark Billingham and I were away doing some events, and to entertain ourselves on the train coming back, we started to think what would be. We started off talking about Johnny Cash and whether he had another album in him that Rick Rubin had tried to literally bring out of the bins almost, you know, to find. And we called this, you know, the bottom of the barrel. That's what we call it. And we thought we were hilarious. We came with this idea of Rick Rubin just following Johnny Cash around the house, trying to catch him humming or singing in the shower, you know, just to try and, you know, just make some more money out of the Johnny Cash thing. We also came up with the idea of the Morrissey reggae album, which the lawyers told us we couldn't do. And considering one of the writers that we were doing it with had actually been sued by Morrissey, we were definitely told we wouldn't be doing that one. Cliff Richard's Devil Worship album's there, though. Myths and Legends of Britain's Entry into the European Common Market on Ice by Rick Wakeman is there. We just wanted to have fun, and we did have fun. We had a stupid amount of fun. All of our books were late. And we came up, and also it's the only book I've ever read that had an index that I think is funnier than the rest of the book. Especially if anybody can remember the kind of Bible puppets that Auntie Jean Morton used to use, Tinker and Tucker. They have a kind of Breaking Bad trajectory in the credits for it. And I just loved it. We loved writing it. And it came out. We expected it to be a Christmas book that people would pick up. And hardly anybody did. And I still think, in all immodesty, it's one of the funniest books ever written. We tried to do an event where we did readings from it, and it was just all of us standing on stage, pissing ourselves laughing. And so we just thought, we can't actually do this again. Please just read the book. But it's the greatest fun I've ever, ever had writing.
I really, really want to hear that Kraftwerk album. The track called I Want to Return This Gift. Hey, meanwhile. Paul, we've talked a little bit about acting, and you have, as far as I know, you don't have a glittering acting career, but of course you have a screenwriting career, and you've had that episode of Elementary. So what was it like writing for an American TV show?
Really exciting, actually. Me and Rob Doherty, the executive producer, put it together in about 6 weeks from this Christmas. We were Skyping to each other on Christmas Eve, things like that, and just a delightful process. He's a lovely individual, and, it was just nice to be included. He asked me 4 years ago to be in the initial writer's room for Elementary, which would mean flying to Los Angeles and working there and living there, and I couldn't leave Britain because of my wife's job. And I think he was impressed by how fast I turned him down, and thought I was thus very high red. And he kept saying, well, no, but even so, chuck me an episode idea. So I got serious about it about a year ago and started chucking him ideas. And he finally said, OK, that one, let's go for it. And we went for it really fast. And he's a big comics fan as well. And the episode is called You've Got Me. What's it called? You've Got Me, Who's Got You? And which is a quote from Superman, the movie. And it's all about superhero comics, which Rob is a huge fan of as well. So, yeah, we just had a lot of fun with it. And I'm in the unfortunate position of the line everyone remembers and keeps thanking me for on Twitter is a line I didn't write, but he did, which is awkward. How did you work all that out? I was bitten by a radioactive detective, but it was a lovely experience, and I went to see some of the filming, and all over in about six weeks. I feel like I've been mugged by somebody sticking a lot of money into my pockets.
I remember back when I had a full-time job that I absolutely loved working at Easter and Christmas and stuff because I could get double or triple time for it. Now, from your point of view, of course, it doesn't matter if you work over at Christmas because you're not going to see Caroline anyway.
Well, that's true. I mean, my wife is a priest, so our busy times coincided this year.
That's very convenient and makes you available when no other scriptwriter is willing to do the job.
That's probably why he hired me.
Marvellous. Now, I've given you all another chance to come up with some questions. Has anybody got any bright ideas yet? Or do I have to get the thumb screws out? Gareth?
You chose Sherlock Holmes as being embedded in London's consciousness. Were you at any point tempted to do Doctor Who?
Well, Sherlock Holmes is just about nicely out of copyright, and Doctor Who very much is not. But I don't think there's anything particularly London about Doctor Who. Sherlock Holmes really is very, very London indeed. And it would have to be a fictional character who's really thoroughly associated with the place. Paddington, yes. Yes, the ghost of Paddington haunts Paddington Station. I think one can say that, giving commuters hard stares. That's one of the less sinister books in the series. Unless he's found dead. It's like Elvis. He had one marmalade sandwich too many.
Mary Poppins. Maybe not.
The government of Peru sent an assassin after Paddington.
he's probably fled with official state secrets or something. Who knows what he's got in that briefcase? Yeah, nobody tell the TSA. It's probably a bomb. Or at least a make-believe one that somebody from Manchester United security people left behind by accident. Any more questions? Yes? No? Already. In which case, let us move on to announcements. Okay.
Is there a chance that other British top sci-fi shows will be created in the next 5 years?
Ooh, that's a good question. Paul is looking puzzled.
Well, I'd like there to be. I'm sure one will. It seems to be sort of crying out for one, doesn't it?
There's like an explosion of sci-fi and fantasy shows in Britain in the mid to late 2000s, but then it's sort of relatively dry now. It sort of died down a bit.
I saw in the news today that the BBC are apparently launching a competitor for Netflix and Amazon TV, and that would seem to me to be a perfect opportunity for them to do this sort of thing.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think Doctor Who's presence takes an awful lot of the ecological niche for a new show, and the fact that Class is coming along as a spin-off will take up some more of that niche. But maybe there's room for something spacey. I'd like there to be.
I mean, I think that they tried Beowulf as a kind of PG-rated Game of Thrones, didn't they? Which was obviously doomed to failure from the start. And of course, Jekyll and Hyde, which didn't work. I think there's still
a prototype Jekyll. It was good for one shot. The current one, Jekyll.
Oh,
Which I enjoyed, but. Clearly, I was in a minority, judging by the rating figures. But I mean, I think that it's a question of. I think there was an explosion, but it's almost because Doctor Who was family orientated. Then there was a big kind of splurge of family orientated sci-fi. I think it would still have to come from the States, in the same way that Game of Thrones was very adult. If HBO or somebody or Showtime was to do an adult-orientated sci-fi series.
This is happening as we speak, The Expanse.
You see, I know nothing, Jon Snow. You see, so that's...
Oh, please, The Expanse is absolutely brilliant, and it's available on Google, so you can watch it in this country. I thoroughly recommend it.
You see, I've just got Netflix. I mean, that's why I haven't got that.
Well, at least you can be watching Jessica Jones.
Oh, I have.
So, right, now I think maybe announcements. We've had Paul's announcement, so there's the book launch. If this won't be out in time for people in London to go to Forbidden Planet, but everybody here, we hope to see you at Forbidden Planet up on Clifton Triangle on Saturday. For the book launch. And also, of course, there is Crime Fest over the weekend. There may still be tickets available. I don't know. I haven't looked, but I'm sure there will be lots of wonderful crime writers there if you are interested in that sort of thing. Furthermore, next Wednesday, Waterstones, in the evening. What time do we start, Pete? Can you remember?
Seven
o'clock. We will have Mike Carey, who is coming to read from his fabulous new book, Fellside. And have a little chat with me. So, Mike Carey, Fans Week. Given that it's also the day that X-Men Age of Apocalypse arrives in the cinemas, we might talk a little bit about X-Men as well, as he's had a fairly lengthy run on that book. But mainly we'll be talking about Fellside and catching up on what's happening with the Girl with All the Gifts film. It's free to attend, but there is an Eventbrite, I think, because they want to catch up on numbers of people. Right, has anybody else got any announcements that they want to make? Joe, what's happening next month?
Yeah, next month, I can't remember the date off the top of my head because I don't have my phone, but next month is Stephanie Burgess and Justin. So, whenever that is going to be.
Right, that presumably is Stephanie Burgess's new thing with opera and all that.
Masks and Shadows, it's called, her new one, yeah. And obviously next week in here is Pub Night, if anybody would like to come down to Pub Night.
Anybody else got any announcements? Pete? No? Jonathan, new books? No? Gareth, new book? Gareth, audiobooks?
Yeah, audiobooks. I don't have any details. all I've done is sign contracts for audio versions of the Three Monkey books, which will be out from Audible at some point in the relatively near future.
Which means somebody gets to yell, "Die, motherfuckers, die," on an audiobook.
Well, I didn't know we were pimping books. So if we're pimping books, my short story collection, A Tiding of Magpies, is out on June the 28th, and there's going to be a book launch and signing at St. John on the Wall, which is a weird crypt in the Bristol wall. And Ian Milstead is going to be launching his book at the same time, which is called Silent Rides Alone.
Ian, come and tell us about your book.
It's a pretty traditional Western, actually. So I wrote it about 4 years ago, and it's eventually coming out. Do come along, please.
Already, lots of Six Guns and Horses and things like that. And St. John in the Wall is a fabulous little venue. It reminds me, actually, that there's at some point, so there's going to be a literary evening raising money for St. Mungo's, which Judy Darley is organising, and she's going to be on my radio show on Wednesday to talk about that. But it's a lovely little venue. I remember Farah Mendelssohn and Edward James were in Bristol for some reason or other, and I was showing them around, and we just walked past this old medieval church in the wall, and they're both historians, and they went poing, in, and they absolutely loved it. It's fascinating. The oldest church in Bristol. It's built actually into the city walls. Any other announcements that we've got? No. Ah, Joe.
Yeah. Sorry, French next month is the 13th.
Alrighty. So, Martin?
Well, only for pimping books still. I'm just going to say I've got some Tanya's and some of the Woman in Black. Not Woman in White. No, that was Wilkie Collins. I'm a pro. I've got some of those with me that I would happily sign for anybody and knock them out with a fiver each if anybody wants any. If anybody wants to find out what happened to Darren after the bit that I read, then I've got some of those with me as well. Thank you.
Alrighty. And I think that's it from everybody, in which case, thank you very much for coming. We'll see you again next month.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.